It's a great school to be up here on behalf of the Base Measures Committee. First of all, B'schus Rabbi Zatz, who so graciously was mochel to give the kavod to Rabbi Leibowitz. I asked to introduce Rabbi Leibowitz specifically because the Rav is someone I spend anywhere from an hour to 2 hours a day. And I wanted to give you just a minute or two of intro. Last time we had Rabbi Leibowitz here, I asked to introduce him also. And because the time I spend with him, I wanted to share just an introduction, not the bio which you read that we send out, but who he is to all of Klal Yisrael. Rabbi Leibowitz is the most listened to shiur in America. He has over 7,000 shiurim on YU Torah and over 1,200,000 listeners. He is heard throughout the country and actually throughout the world. His Talmidim are people who not only listen to his shiurim daily, as I do, for sometimes hours, but people who develop a personal relationship with him. In a shiur I just heard by Rav Shai Shechter about his father, who said, told his father that, look at all the Talmidim you have and all the influences you have throughout Klal Yisrael, because now your Talmidim are Rabbanim. And the prime example is here sitting before us, Rabbi Leibowitz, who is Talmudim called Rav Shechter, but he himself, Rav Leibowitz, has Talmidim who are beginning to become Rabbanim, influencing people, and who have influenced a generation and their children and all of Klal Yisrael at this point in time. He is someone who is regarded by Gadol Yisrael as the future of Torah. His Mesorah and his teaching of Torah Moshe Sinai, is only matched with his humility and his kindness and his uniqueness of dealing with people on a one-to-one basis. I could go on forever, but we're all here really to hear him. And as B'kavod Gadol, I'd like to introduce Rabbi Leibowitz. By the way, this year is sponsored by the Small and Schutz family, as well as an anonymous sponsor for Refuah Shleima for Aaron Meir Ben Yael Merim.
Okay. Thank you, Henry, for that ridiculous introduction. Today we're going to be talking about an interesting topic because it's a topic that I never learned about when I was... I wasn't prepared for this when they prepared me for smicha, when they prepared me to be a rabbi. They never prepared me for certain types of shailas, for certain types of questions that I got. And I'd like to share a sampling of the kinds of questions that rabbis get, and I think I'm not unique in this regard. I got a shaila a number of years ago. A guy calls me up, an old Talmud of mine. He's been married for about a year now, and his wife, when she was taking Kala classes, the Kala teacher told her that it was a very big skula for Banim Talmidei Chachamim that they should give tzedakah every time they're mekayim the mitzvah of Ona. Every time it's Tashra Mita, they should give tzedakah. And they took upon themselves this practice, and the fellow now recently lost his job. And he had been giving X amount of dollars every single time, and now he's concerned that he can no longer afford to live ki'ish v'ishto because of this minhag. So he wanted to know, does he have to be matir neder? That's shaila number one. They don't prepare you for this. Shaila number two. I got an email. The email reads as follows. A relative of mine was pregnant and the baby was in the wrong position, with the head up and the feet down. She was already in her eighth or ninth month, and the doctor said she will for sure need a cesarean. They asked me to ask Rav Sternbach for a bracha or an etza. When I told him the story, he told me that there's a segula which Diane Fisher used to tell people to do, and is baduk umenusa. The couple goes to the sataf alone when no one is looking, and the husband catches the water straight from the waterfall in his mouth, and then puts it directly into his wife's mouth. It sounded a little strange to me, but I gave over the message. In any case, they went and tried it, and the baby turned over in the right direction. I've told this to a few other people, and get this, sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. And a third example, a third shaila, also an email. This is from a young lady who I don't think I know her personally, but she sent as follows. Rabbi Leibowitz, hope this email finds you well. Let's skip that part. I have a few fundamental shailas to ask about a segula scenario that recently came up, but I think the questions make more sense if I start with the scenario. The following scenario truly happened. My friend recently had a vart and ran over to us as we were leaving, saying she had a present for us. Holding a bag, she hands each of us a kitchen knife in a slipcase so that it wouldn't be hazardous, decorated with beads because it was a present, not because it had to do with the skula. She then explained that her chassan and his friends heard of this skula where you buy a knife and you wait to use it for the first time on Rosh Hashanah as a skula for a shidduch. He and his friends tried it and they all got engaged this year. My mom will call you 2 days before Rosh Hashanah to remind you to use it, but hold on to it. Now, my friend honestly means well, but we've had this discussion before about how skulas and how tefillah is really the way to go about these things, but she personally really wanted to get married, tried every skula in the book, like cutting her hair an inch shorter than she normally would. Again, I'd like the book. I don't have the book. I need the book to know what these skulas are. Cutting her hair an inch shorter than she normally would. I didn't know that skula, nor could I ever fulfill it. And now she's engaged. So she just thought, because it worked for her, she would help us out too. So if we wouldn't take the knife, she'd be very upset. Are we allowed to take this knife? And she goes on to ask whether it's avodah zarah, whether she has to burn the knife. Okay, she went a little bit far, maybe in the line of questioning. And then a very common one that I've gotten several times: a woman who is pregnant will ask that she's accompanying a friend to the mikveh because the friend is having trouble conceiving, and she was told that it's a great skula that if she goes to the mikveh the same time as a pregnant woman going to the mikveh, and the pregnant woman wants to know, does she need to do all the preparations for the mikveh that a woman would normally do if she's going for the purpose of segula? So all of these questions are questions that, again, as far as I know, and I can't say that I know all Dalu Chalkei Shulchan Aruch, but you learn Dalu Chalkei Shulchan Aruch and you're not going to find these tricks and these ways of improving your life. So what is the number one argument you'll get if you try to push back a little bit is, it can't hurt. Those three words. It can't hurt. So the question I guess we're here to deal with this morning is that true? Is it true that it just can't hurt? That you might as well. You might as well try these things that seem ridiculous, that don't really seem to have any basis in Torah's Moshe Mi-Sinai. Or do you say, you know, this is ridiculous. This is not our religion. It may be some religion. Some of them may belong to some religion, but certainly not our religion. So yeah, I think it's important to just take a step back and analyze what the halachic issues are over here. Like, what could the problem be? So there is an issur in the Torah, two issur in the Torah. Lo senachshu v'lo so'aneinu. These are two separate issurim. Lo senachshu means that a person is should not take something as a simin if it doesn't make any sense that it would be a simin to determine his course of behavior. Say a person is not sure if he's going to buy a certain stock, a person is not sure if he's going to make a certain decision in his life, where he's going to go for the summer, which job he's going to take. So you should not say, well, if the next car that drives by is red or blue, then I'll take the job. That's a simin min hashamayim that God is telling me that I should take the job. And if the next car that drives by is white or black, then I won't take the job, because it has no relevance whatsoever. What's happening with the cars that are driving down the street clearly has nothing to do with your life's decisions, and that's an isidor raisa. It's not just, it can't hurt. That's an isidor if you believe that you're doing that because that is a simin from God. If you're just an indecisive person, so you flip a coin because you just can't decide things on your own, that's probably not an isidor of lo senachshu. But if you think that it's God telling you that this is what you must do because that is the simin that you made up in your own mind, so then that would be a violation of lo senachshu. That's the violation of nichush. Now, in the Gemara, there do seem to be certain violations of this. The Gemara seems to say in a couple of places that if they weren't sure about something, they would ask a child. They would say to a yanuka, to a child, psokli psukeh, come tell me a pasuk that you learned, and they'll use that pasuk to determine that it's some sort of simen min hashamayim. So and in fact, there's something called a goral hagra that was once popular, much less so now, but they say that it was practiced as recently as the 20th century. The story goes, and I don't think anyone denies the story, that when Rav Aaron Cutler I think it was Rav Aaron Cutler did a Goral Agra to determine whether to join his father-in-law Rav Yisrael Meltzer in Eretz Yisrael or whether to join Rav Moshe Feinstein and try to build Yiddishkeit in America, that he did a Goral Agra and he took a chumash, it opened up to a certain place, and he found a pasuk that said, Aaron, you should go join Moshe, your brother. So he took that as a simon that he should go join Rav Moshe Feinstein and not go to Eretz Yisrael, and the rest is history. And now we have Lakewood with 7,000 Bachram, or however many people, not just Bachram Avreichem, however many people there are learning in Lakewood. So the Rishonim deal with that issue of Pesuk Li Pesukeich and using Pesukim to determine what a person should do. And they essentially say that it's Torah Shebichsav is different. That when it comes to Torah Shebichsav, specifically it's going to be different. Rav Schechter often points out that even so, even if you know how to do a Goral Agra, or you're one who feels that you're on the Madrega to rely on a Goral Agra, it only works with Chumash. I mean, Rav Schechter often points out that when it comes to, let's say, certain Chassidus, that is what my father-in-law was referring to. When it comes to certain Chassidus, sometimes they'll take a letter of the Rebbe, and they'll say, oh, I'll open up to a letter of the Rebbe, and he'll determine, he'll give me a tshuva. Sometimes you'll hear, that's the way people will talk. They'll say, we asked the Rebbe Shaila, the Rebbe died already, but no, we'll ask him a Shaila. What does it mean they asked him a Shaila? It doesn't mean that they believe that they're conversing with him. It means that they'll open up the igros, they'll open up the letters, and if the letter says a certain topic, then they'll take that we were mekabel tshuva, that we were mekabel tshuva from the Rebbe. So that's the pashim shot, is that that's a violation of nichush, that has nothing to do, only chumash you're allowed to do that with, you're not allowed to do that with anything else, and even chumash were somewhat limited to the kinds of people that are able to do it. So it seems that that would be a violation of nichush. Rav Schechter often tells the story of the fellow, the woman in his in Tannersville who wasn't sure what to do with her son for the summer. She wasn't sure, should she bring him to Tannersville? Should she send him to a certain sleepaway camp that she was considering sending him to? So she wanted to take the Rebbe's letters and open up and see what the Rebbe's tshuva was going to be. But she didn't unpack all of her boxes yet, so she didn't have the Rebbe's letters, but she had a cookbook. So she took her cookbook and she opened up, and it opened up right there to a dessert that her son loves to eat in Tannersville over the summers. So she knew that that's a siman min hashamayim to bring him. So that's obviously ridiculous, but it's worse than ridiculous. It's a violation of losanach, right? That would be a violation of an iser da'oraisa, and l'chora it's no different when you use any book to do the same thing. That would seem to be a violation. Now, wait, every Rosh Hashanah we do something that seems like this. We take pomegranates, and we say, oh, because I'm eating pomegranates, so yir b'zuchuyosenu karimon. Now I'm going to have so many zuchuyos. This is going to bring me mitzvahs like a rimon, like a pomegranate. So isn't that a violation of nichush? There's a guy I know that I've become friendly with over the years who's a caterer. Every year and every Rosh Hashanah for the past few years, he's brought me the head of a lamb. It's not something I would ever buy, but we use it as like a gag gift around the house, you know, but the head of a lamb. Why do we do that? She Rosh Velola Zanav, and this is recorded in Shulchan Aruch. This is something that we certainly do. That's certainly a minhag Yisrael. So the Nesivos explains that one. The Nesivos explains that no, what if I don't eat the head of a lamb? So now I'm going to be a Zanav. Now I'm going to be a tail. I'm not going to be a head. We never really use the head of the lamb. We sort of keep it in the fridge. We don't leave it out on the table too much. But we'll take like a jellyfish, you know, the candy jellyfish, and cut off, you know, use the heads of those. Those are much more palatable than the head of a lamb. But if I don't eat it, then I'm going to be a zanav. I'm not going to be a rosh if I don't have these simanim. So the Nesivos explains, no, the primary element of all of the simanim that we do on Rosh Hashanah is the tefillah that we say along with it. That along with having it there, we say yihi ratzon, and we daven to Hashem that we should be l'rosh v'lo l'zanav, that yitamu sonenu, that our enemies and those who hate us should be wiped out. That's the ikur. We do believe in tefillah. I mean, we are a religion. We do believe in God, and we believe that we can communicate with God. Not only do we believe that we can communicate with God, we also believe that a person who does not communicate with God is fundamentally lacking in his emunah, that a person has to be able to pray. One of my favorite shuvas from Rav Moshe Feinstein, there's the Mashkiach in Landers, Rabbi Moshe Bamberger, and he wrote a book last year called Great Jewish Books, where he collected the 100 most influential, in his view, most influential Jewish books in history. And he has like a page or two about each of them, and he tries to pick out like one piece that really tells you about the nature of the author or the nature of the book. So it's a fun game to play. If you're ever on a long trip and you want to go through, you know, pick one Rashi ala Torah. That's the most impactful. It's not so easy, right? Pick one Rambam in Mishnah Torah. That's the most impactful Rambam in Mishnah Torah. So pick one Igros Moshe, one Tshuva from a Moshe. So I had two in mind. He picked the other one. He didn't pick this one. But one of them was my favorite one just because I think it's such an important statement about Emunah. Rav Moshe has a Tshuva about school prayer. And Rav Moshe discusses whether a child is allowed to participate with Jews and non-Jews together praying some non-denominational type of tefillah. And in the course of that tshuva, Rav Moshe writes that non-Jews are obligated to pray. But wait, you learn Masech Sanhedrin, it's not one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. Prayer is not one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. So how can you say that a non-Jew is obligated to pray? So Rav Moshe says, well, the basis of all Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach is that they have to believe in Hashem. Right, if they're just doing the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, but without a belief in the one and only God, then it's not really a fulfillment of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. And Rav Moshe writes, it's impossible to have Emunah B'Hashem if you don't communicate with Hashem. Meaning, it's not the same God that we're believing in if you're not communicating with that God. If you don't believe that there's the ability for human beings to communicate with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, so Tefillah certainly we believe very strongly in Tefillah. It's a mitzvah daraisa, well known machlokes in Rambam and Ramban. I was taught years ago, Rabbi Maurice Lamb, Zichrono Livracha, lived around the corner from me for many years, so we became very close, and he told me, he critiqued my drasha once, and he told me, you should never say that something is well known or famous. Because if you say that, somebody doesn't know it, then you made them feel like a fool, and you should never make your audience feel small. So some people are aware that there's a machlokas between the Rambam and Ramban, whether Tefillah Daraisa is Bechol Yom, or Tefillah Daraisa is only Be'ez Tzara, is only at a time when, but certainly we believe very strongly in Tefillah. So the ikar of the simanim, the whole idea of doing the simanim, is that it is a tefillah. Now the Ramban writes in his commentary on Chumash that just like that we have such a notion by nevuah that a Navi can deliver a message, but sometimes the Navi is called upon to not just deliver a message, but to do so with a poel dimyon, to do so with some sort of prop to sort of convey the message. And when the Nevuah comes with some sort of prop, with some sort of external symbol of the Nevuah, then the Nevuah is going to be a much stronger kind of Nevuah. So the Nesiva suggests the same might be true with Tefillah. That specifically when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, we have props for our Tefillah. But that's what they are. It's not that when you eat the pomegranate, now all of a sudden you're going to be full of mitzvos because a pomegranate, you fall believe has 613 seeds or something like that. It's not that the eating of the pomegranate really does anything. It's a poel dimyon in order to enhance our kavanah in the tefillah, which sometimes has a negative effect. If a person just uses it as a joke and thinks that the whole thing is silly, then obviously it's not a very meaningful tefillah. So that's one isser called losa nachshu. There's another isser called losa onenu. Losa onenu means that we shouldn't think that there's such a thing as a lucky time and an unlucky time. That otherwise intelligent people, very often will have the impression, oh, if it's Friday the 13th, then I can't do something because that's an unlucky time. Civilized people sometimes will give up on religion, but they don't give up on superstitions for some reason. So people have these ridiculous superstitions. Now there are some exceptions. It seems to be, for example, we have a tradition that Adar Chodesh Adar is Bari Mazali, that it has a good mazel during Chodesh Adar. First 9 days of Chodesh Av, at least, it's a discussion exactly for how long. The Mishnah only tells us that Misha Nichnas Av Mimat in Besimcha doesn't say when that stops, but let's assume at least until Tisha B'Av, right? Misha Nichnas Av Mimat in Besimcha, it's considered to have a bad mazel. So Shachter often points out that that's also misunderstood. That a bad mazel, so for example, let's say someone has to have surgery. So a lot of times people say, I'm not going to do it during the 9 days. It's a bad mazel. It's a bad time to have surgery during the 9 days. So he said, no, that's probably not what it means. And this is a machlokas haposkim. Others disagree with Rav Shachter about this, but he says, probably not what it means. Mazali probably means that in comparison to the Umos HaOlam, that if we are ever going to face a confrontation, then our mazel is going to have the lower hand and their mazel is going to have the upper hand. For example, the Gemara gives the example of a court case, that you're facing a court case against somebody else, so it's me or them. But when your surgeon is performing surgery on you, he's not working against you, hopefully. He's working with you, for you. He's trying to make it better, so maybe that would not even be buried. That, that would not be included in Reya Mazale. Muka Yosef quotes that a person is put in this court in Shulchan Aruch to schedule weddings at the beginning of the month. Why? Because the moon at the beginning of the month is growing. It's getting bigger every day. So it's a siman that the love between the chasen and kala should continue to grow. And he quotes that there are those who say that it's usur to be makbid about that because it's a violation of believing that there are lucky and unlucky times. But then he says, ultimately, Muka Yosef, Mesach Sanhedrin says, it's mutter because it's a siman tov. It's a good siman. Why is it mutter? You believe that getting married, that you're going to have a happier marriage when you got married at the beginning of the month. I happen to have gotten married at the beginning of the month. So far, so good. But I don't believe it's because we got married at the beginning of the month, right? So why is that mutter to be makbid, to try to get married at the beginning of the month? So Muki Yosef explains that it's not that you believe that that's what's going to cause a better marriage, but he says, L'mashal, let's say a kala wears a white dress. Why does a kala wear a white dress? What's the point? Why a white dress?
Purity.
Is she going to be less pure if she wears a different colored dress? No, but it's symbolic of purity. You try to, you know, the same reason a chassan wears a suit or a tuxedo or whatever, something dresses nicely for the wedding. You do what's appropriate. So you try to wear things that are symbolic of proper ideas. So maybe that's what the getting married at the beginning of the month. You know, in the Rebbetzin Meiselman's biography of the Soloveitchik family, they printed the invitation to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's wedding, the Rav's parents, Rav and Rebbetzin Soloveitchik's wedding. And they got married at the end of a month. They didn't know that, yeah, you're only allowed to get married at the beginning of the month, but they were not only ignorant about that, they also apparently didn't know that you're not allowed to write the woman's first name. You have to only write Viraya So, because they accidentally wrote the first name as well. No, but there's no isser of getting married at the end of a month. You're allowed to get married at the end of a month. It's just that it's a positive siman to do so. Then, so these are the Isurim Daraisa, Lo Sinach, Lo Sonein. Then you have other Isurim that also may be Daraisa. There is an Isur called Chukas HaGayim, Chukoseim Lo Selechu, that a person is not allowed to go in the ways of the Gayim. So now, not every idea that Gayim thought of is necessarily Asur Mishum Chukas HaGayim. Rav Shachter used to always give the example, he would say, just because the French eat French fries, it doesn't mean that French fries is Asur. I don't think French eat French fries, but you know, that it doesn't, but the point is that there's a good logical reason why they would do it. I remember Rav Shachter sitting in Shir saying, but like things that have no logical reason, that are just purely the styles of the Gayim, and he picked up his tie, he said, like wearing a tie, that lechor is chukas hagayim. And we're like, the Yesh Lomar, you know, what's the answer? He never explained. But the Chukas HaGayim is not just anything that the non-Jews happen to do. If there's a scientific reason that something should work, even if we don't necessarily understand it, called over Sheish Bo Mishum Refua, Ein Bo Mishum Darkei Amori. If there's a scientific explanation that something works, then it's not considered a superstition. The Rambam, for example, rejected many medical practices that come up in Chazal. The Magen Avraham writes inside of Shulchan Aruch that fish and meat is not a big deal anymore because it's not dangerous. Now, for years we thought it was dangerous. Chazal assumed it was dangerous to eat fish and meat together. So it's not dangerous to eat fish and meat together. So generally speaking, we still try to be makbid about that because Shulchan Aruch quotes it. Because Shulchan Aruch is concerned that maybe it is dangerous and we just don't know about it. We just don't understand the human body well enough. But certainly, the medicine, as our understanding of medicine changes, it's not that everything Chazal says that automatically we have to superstitiously believe that their medicine was better than modern medicine. The Gemara never says anything, for example, about how to cut your nails. Later poskim talk about cutting fingernails and toenails in a certain order, not on the same day, and skipping. So Rav Shachter thought that the whole pshat in that is that you need to focus, otherwise you'll cut your finger off. I don't know. I thought that was an interesting take. The Gemara in Yevamos, for example, talks about an isha katla. A woman who's been married to a few men and they've each died, so it's asur to marry Nisha Kadlanis. So the Gemara has a machlokas. First, there's a machlokas tanaim. How many times? How many husbands have to have died before she becomes a Kadlanis? That's a machlokas tanaim that really relates to all of Shas in terms of how many times it takes to create a chazaka. But then you also have a machlokas amoroyim. Why? What's the problem with Nisha Kadlanis? One possibility, the Gemara says, maybe she has bad mazel, and the other possibility is that she has some sort of disease. disease that's an STD that's being transmitted to each husband that they were unable to test for. Nafkamina would be if, let's say, they had erisin but not nisuin. Her husbands keep dying after erisin before nisuin. So it is her mazel, bad mazel, but it would not be any sort of disease. Or if, let's say, the husband dies, but we know why he died. It wasn't from any disease. He fell off a building. He got hit by a truck. Something else happened that we know exactly what happened that had nothing. Or she's a young woman. She keeps marrying 97-year-old men. And sure enough, they keep dying within 5-10 years of her getting married. So we wouldn't say that in that case she's an Isha Katlanis. But what's interesting in terms of our topic is that the Rambam writes in a tshuva that the Rimigash used to be Mesarer Kiddushin for Isha Katlanis. Because he held that if... we don't know of any disease, if medically there's no concern, if doctors examine her and tell us that she's perfectly fine and there's no reason to assume that she's transmitting any disease, then he says, the Rambam writes, it's al tzad hanichush va'apachad va'timon, that all of this is all because people are fearful, but it has nothing to, it's not really, and you should know, when the Rambam quotes the Rimigash, that's a very big deal. We think of the big Rishonim, and rightfully so, as Rashi and the Rambam, because we rely, and the Rashba, and a handful of others as the major Rishonim. In the Rambam's world, the Rimigash was the great Rishon, right? The Rimigash was, the Rambam refers to him as his Rebbe, even though he wasn't really the Rambam's Rebbe, because the Rimigash died when the Rambam was like 5 or 6 years old, but there was a meeting between the Rambam and the Rimigash. The Rimigash was the Rebbe of the Rambam's father. So the Rambam, when he was a little boy, when the Rimigash was dying, the Rambam's father brought the Rambam to the Rimigash. And the Rimigash gave him a bracha that he should be a Nesher Gadol, he should be a great eagle in the Jewish people, and either the bracha was Mekuyim or it was a really good guess, because the Rambam became what the Rambam became. And when the Rambam talks about the Rimigash, he talks about like a Malach Hashem Tzvakos, that he was talking about someone who was just beyond. Then there's another issue called Ayin Hara. The Gemara Masechta Bava Basra has a whole sugya about building a wall and who pays for it. True. The Gemara discusses that if you have a neighbor and you don't want people to be looking into each other's fields, so they have to build a wall between them in order that they shouldn't cause ayin hara. What do you mean ayin hara? Well, I'm going to be planting and growing all my produce in my field. It's going to be super successful, and everyone's going to be looking in from the other side and seeing how successful I am. That's going to bring about ayin hara. To flaunt one's success brings about ayin hara. So how do you deal with ayin hara? So one way to deal with it: build a wall, and that way they won't be able to see. No one's going to become jealous because no one will see. Meaning, the real answer to ayin hara is not as commonly believed. What's commonly believed? The red string, right? The red bendel. It's not. That also comes up in Chazal. The Tosefta Masechta Shabbos tells us that that's Darkei Amori. That that's a violation of the Issur of Darkei Amori. I tried to find a source once for the red bendel. So I found the Debrei Tzina Rav writes in the Tshuva, in his Tshuva's Ber Moshe, that the Tosefta says it's Darkei Amori, but my grandmother used to insist that we wear it, and she was a very pious Jewess, so it can't be that it's a violation of Darkei Amori. I don't know. It seems that the Tosefta says that it's Darkei Amori. So what is the Eitzah? How do you get around Ayin Hara? The way to get around Ayin Hara is by being Tzanua, by not flaunting all of our success, by not flaunting all of our wealth. This is a major problem in today's society, where every time we do anything good or anything good happens to us, it didn't happen unless there's a selfie to document it that can then go on a Twitter or Facebook so that the world can see just how successful we are. I have cousins that live in Eretz Yisrael, and my mother-in-law used to tell us that it's unbelievable. They're always happy. The children are always happy. Like, when do you see them? I see all the pictures on Facebook. They're always happy. So, mommy, I don't think they're posting the pictures of the kids crying. In fact, every family that ever went to Disney World has pictures of the whole family smiling in front of the castle, right? Very few have pictures of the kids killing each other in the back of the car on the way there. But it happens to all of us, I think. I don't think I'm unique in this regard. It happens to all of us. But when we flaunt all of our successes and everything that's going well, then that causes ayin hara. The protection from ayin hara, like we said, is tzniyus. and a sense of Einod Milvado. Now, I do want to highlight that tefillah is a very important thing. As we mentioned before, we do communicate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through tefillah, but even tefillah has limitations. The Gemara Maseches Brachos says that you're not allowed to daven once a woman is pregnant. It's forbidden to daven for the gender of the child. The Gemara says you can't daven Yiratzon Sheteile Dishti Zachar, that my wife should have a boy. I don't know what that would be like. I never davened that my wife should have a boy. The only time we ever hoped for a particular gender was after four boys, and we really wanted a girl already. So that was the hope. I remember each time we'd go to the doctor, the doctor would say after the delivery, oh, it's another boy, I'll see you in 2 years. Another boy, see you in 2 years. Then my daughter was born, the doctor says, I'm not going to see you in 2 years, am I? She didn't. But the Gemara discusses that you're not allowed to daven that it should be a boy because it's too late. It's already determined what the child is, and you're not allowed to daven for a miracle. You're not allowed to daven that Hashem should change it. The Gemara asks the Kasha, what about who did daven that the gender should change? Leah, daven that Dina should change. So the Gemara gives answers, somewhat cryptic. You have to figure out what the answers mean. Gemara says, Maisa Nisim Shaini, something like that, that someone of Tzadekes, of Leah's stature, maybe is allowed to daven for something. The Gemara said, the Mishnah says, you hear some Kol Tzvacha Be'ir, you hear some commotion going on in the city, and you're coming home, you're not allowed to daven, let it not be in my house. It is. It either is or isn't. But you can't daven for something that's already been determined. Whenever we daven retrospectively, when we daven about the past, it's always hoda'ah. We do tefillah ala asid, hoda'ah al ha'avar. Right? We daven for things in the future. In the past tense, we're thanking Hashem for what's already been done. In fact, there's even a discussion, I think last time I was in B'nai Yerushalayim, we discussed this, there's even a discussion about whether you're allowed to daven for a terminally ill person. If it's the doctors say, look, we're just making them comfortable now. Are you still allowed to daven for Refuah Shleima? So Rav Shechter very strongly believes no. That before he visits the hospital, he'll ask the doctors, is there any hope for this patient? Because he needs to know what the nature of his tefillah should be. Because he does plan on davening for them, but you daven that they should be comfortable and happy and that they should be able to withstand whatever Nisyonos HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives them, or do you daven that they should have a Refuah Shleima? So once it would take a miracle, it could be that even though we believe God is capable of any and every miracle, we're not allowed to daven for those miracles. The Stipler disagreed. The Stipler held that you're allowed to daven because we have so little understanding of the human body. We're just scratching the surface, the beginning to understand some of the ways that the human body works, that we can't ever know for sure that it's a miracle, because miracles happen every day in hospitals, and likely the reason they happen every day is because they're not really miracles, but we just don't really understand what's happening. So let's go through some famous skulas. Now that we know the Isurim, let's go through some of the well-known skulas and see what the issues might be. So there is a skula that folding a talis is a skula for Shalom Bayis. So why is folding a talis a skula for Shalom Bayis? So Rosh Hashanah likes to say, because if you fold clothing, then it means you are likely a neat person. And it is a good skula for Shalom Bayis to be a neat person. They say, Maisa with the Satmar Rebbe, that a chassid was folding his talis over and over again after Shabbos. It was already an hour and a half after Shabbos, and the guy was still folding his talis. And the Rebbe said to him, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm having terrible Shalom Bayis problems, so I want to really get it perfect. So he said, well, your wife just did all the dishes after Shabbos, cleaned up the whole house by herself. Maybe it would be a bigger skula for Shalom Bayis to go help your wife out. There's a famous skula that's become very popular even in modern Orthodox communities called Shlissel Challah, that right after the Shabbos after Pesach, people put a key in their challah. I got a phone call from a family member once that there was a Shalom Bayis issue, not like a serious Shalom Bayis issue, but husband and wife were fighting, were arguing because the husband heard that the wife had put a key in the challah. He opened up the oven while the challah was still baking, ripped the key out of the challah, and destroyed his wife's challah. So do we have to do that necessarily? But what is it? What's it based on? So this comes already from the early 19th century. The Abt Rav writes that there's such a segula. But why is it a segula? So they point out that the Gemara in the beginning of Taina says that Kosh Baruch Hu keeps complete control over three keys. The keys to Parnasa, to Tchias HaMesim, and to Banim, to having children. children. So the minhag was to, or that the Abdur Rav suggests, and he claims that it was an older minhag, was to remind ourselves that Kodesh Baruch Hu controls Parnassah, which is the exact opposite of the kavan of most people who do Shlissel Challah. Meaning the whole point was that you have some sort of key to remind you that Hashem alone controls the key to your Parnassah. Not that whether you put a key in the Challah controls your key to Parnassah. I get such difficult shaylas sometimes. Do I put my house key, my office key, my Parnassah comes from the office, doesn't come from the house? You know, do I put the up the top lock, the bottom lock, the car keys, if it's a nice car, not a nice car, what about my kid's car? You know, so how many challahs do I have to make? What if I only have one key and five challahs? All these difficult, the point is that you're supposed to daven. That's the point, that you're supposed to daven the Kodesh Baruch Hu and recognize that it all comes from a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Failure to recognize that is a violation of Lo Sinachshu. The Shulchan Aruch recommends reciting Parshas Haman every day. A lot of times I get an email every Tuesday of Parshas B'Shalach. Ooh, it's coming up soon. Every Tuesday of Parshas B'Shalach, not an email, I get inundated with emails of, don't forget, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Mirimanov, who I cannot tell you anything else that he ever said, but Rabbi Menachem Mendel Mirimanov says that you have to say Parshas Haman today if you want to make a good Parnassa. So the truth is, Shulchan Aruch talks about saying Parshas Haman, and Shulchan Aruch says you should say it every day. Why? Well, Parshas Haman, oh, it's such a good school. If I say Parshas Haman, then I'll make a good Parnassa. No, the idea is, what is Parshas Haman? Let's think for a second. What is Parshas Haman? That the man comes from Shemayim. Was there ever a point in history where things were more evident that everything comes from Kodesh Baruch Hu, that everything comes from the Ribono Shel Olam, than the man? So the point of reading Parshas Haman is to remind us that it's all from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, not that it's some magic words that you say and then you're going to have a parnasa. There's a famous segula. It's mentioned in the Rama and Shulchan Aruch. Rama says not to give sanduk to in the same family to the same person more than once. They should spread the wealth a little bit because it's a skula for Ashirus. So that comes from the fact that the Medrash relates being sandik to being maktir ketores. And by ketores, there's a halacha chadashim leketores, chadashim bovi afisu, that new people come and bring the ketores because it's a skula for Ashirus. And we assume that we want to spread the wealth as much as we can. So, you know, they say that that the Gra writes in his commentary in Shulchan Aruch, actually, he says, I don't know. I've been sandik many times, still not experiencing the Ashirus. He's been sandik and all. So they say that they asked the stipler, the stipler, like his son of Chaim Kanievsky and like his Mechutin Rav Yashiv, would go around being sandik for hundreds and hundreds of children. My brother is a moel, got trained in Eretz Yisrael. So when he was training by Maishla, who's a big moel in Yerushalayim, so they would go to Rav Yashiv and they would just sit there all morning, and one baby after another, they would bring in babies to be sandik for one baby after another. So they asked the stipler, Rav Shmuel Marcus told me, they asked the stipler once, where's the Ashirus? I don't see that you're a rich man. He said, is there any greater Ashirus than having a son like Rav Chaim? Meaning it's all about how you define Ashirus, perhaps. But that was, but even that, the Nadav Yehuda rejects that as a school. The Nadav Yehuda says, Sandik doesn't do it. He says, Ketores, what was so special about Ketores is that it was so rare, that it was only happening once every day. But Sandiks are all over the place every single day. There are, Baruch Hashem, there are all sorts of, there are so many babies being born into Klal Yisrael. So the Nadav Yehuda disagrees with the entire premise. There's another famous Gula, and I realize that it's getting later, but there's another famous school of getting a mezuzah or a ksuba checked. If you go and you bring your ksuba to somebody who tells you that, oh, these names are all wrong, and that's why your shalom bias is problematic, or that's why you're suffering from whatever yisurin that you're suffering from, we're getting your mezuzah checked, and they'll tell you just by reading between the lines of the mezuzah. So the truth is, it's a good idea to get your mezuzah checked, but stop to get your mezuzah, because that, there's a mitzvah called mezuzah. You know, by mezuzah in particular, Marv Rabbi Shechter is so adamant against segulas that even when the sources really seem to indicate that mezuzah is a protection, if you learn through the Rishonim, like really seem to indicate very strongly that mezuzah provides some sort of actual protection. So when we were learning Hilchas Mezuzah, he would always say, yeah, because it's a mitzvah, and a kiyum mitzvah provides protection. He would always just like, no, but that's not what no, it's a kiyum mitzvah, So a mitzvah provides protection, that he didn't want to hear that there's any other possibility. But to get them checked, yeah, to make sure that they're kosher, but to get them checked by someone who's going to read read in between the lines, you know, Rav Bakshi Doron has a tshuva in Tshuva's Binyanav, where about the idea of Tam Tiyem Hashem Elokecha, that's the title of the tshuva, and he goes through all the Baba Maises that aren't meaningful, and he says how dangerous it is about getting a ksuba check that someone's going to change a name, and now you're not going to have a kosher ksuba because they didn't really change their name, but they just tell you should be called by a different name, and they cause all sorts of problems by telling you instead of going to a therapist to work out your shalom bias problems, you think you're working out your shalom bias problems by having some guy tell you that that there's a problem with your ksuba. So Rav Bakshi Doron prints in that tshuva that he wrote to Rav Vosner because one of these fellows was going around reading people's ksubas. You know, Rav Yaakov Hillel writes in his sefer. Rav Yaakov Hillel is one of the great mekubalim of our time. He says when a mekubal comes to your town, every rav in every town should invite the mekubal to say a shir to the local kollel. And if he refuses, then he shouldn't be working as a mekubal. Meaning, you first have to make sure that he can say a shir to the local kollel. If he's comfortable enough to say a shir on a high madrega, then maybe there's what to talk about. But so Rav Bakshi Doron writes to Rav Vosner that this guy came with a haskama from you. That so what's going on? So Rav Vosner writes, Ein das chachamim noche emenu milvad b'ksuba shenim tzuba psul al pi halacha las ksuba d'shtachach b'psulta. He said, only thing I ever wrote haskama to is that if he finds a psul al pi halacha, that you could fix it. Avalo maisem asher lo yasu lahachnis machshavos b'hamonim shemikreim balahem mikoach haksuba, to put thoughts in people's heads that things happen because of the ksuba. B'makom la'orer al tshuva maisem tovim, instead of doing what a rabbi is supposed to do, which is try to inspire people to tshuva and Maisim Tovim, and says Rav Vosner, Zechron Levracha, Kvar Shalachti Lo Da'ati Bazeh Kama Pa'amim, I already sent a letter to this fellow many times explaining to him that he's got to stop. Ukanira humisu kazeh she'enotzayas. It seems to me that he's among this group of people that just doesn't listen. That no matter what you say, he's not going to listen. The Gemara says someone who's zayir b'ner having no banim talmidei chachamim. So that's a skula that the Gemara talks about, because the Gemara itself says that ner Shabbos promotes shalom bayis. There's no greater skula for banim talmidei chachamim than to have proper shalom bayis. In general, it's an important hashkafa that a person should realize that religious growth works best and really only works on a foundation of emotional health. That if a child is not emotionally healthy, as a Rebbe I've seen many times teaching in high school for 18 years, where a kid all of a sudden he's growing payus and he's dressing differently and he's doing all sorts of different things, and like you just see that there's something so unstable at the foundation, and you know that all that religious growth is here today, gone tomorrow. It's not real growth. Religious growth happens when there's emotional health. So of course, if there's going to be shalom bayis, that's a wonderful skula for banim talmidei chachamim. So just to conclude, let's go back to the actual shailas that we started with, these skulas that we started with. So the minhag tov to give tzedakah every time that the Kala teacher taught, to give tzedakah every time the mekayim mitzvah of ona. So when I heard that, I thought this sounded very Christian. Oh, that you need a kapara every time, that it sounded like it's as if that this is, we hold it's a mitzvah of ona. You don't need atonement for it. You don't need to give tzedakah. So I asked Rav Schachter. He said, no, it's not. It's a minhag tov. It's fine. I asked my brother, if you don't know my brother, which very few of you here do know my brother, then you won't appreciate exactly, you know, this line. But my brother has a strong way of expressing things sometimes. My brother's a very big Talmud Chacham. He's Rosh Kollel in Palo Alto, California, and he has a very strong way of expressing things. He said, is it a minhag tov to give tzedakah every time you're in the mitzvah of ona? It's a minhag tov to give tzedakah anytime you do anything. It's a minhag tov to give tzedakah with every bowel movement. It's a minhag tov. Meaning anytime you decide that you're going to give tzedakah, it's a minhag tov. It's always a good idea to give tzedakah. So I asked Rav Schachter about this school, and Rav Schachter said that he understands it. He said, you know, the Mishnah Berurah writes that when a woman lights Ner HaShabbos, she should give some tzedakah to strengthen the mitzvah of Ner HaShabbos, because Ner HaShabbos, the Gemara says, Zar b'ner havin l'banim talmidei chachamim. So Shach said, what do you think is a greater skula for banim talmidei chachamim? Lighting Ner HaShabbos or mitzvah zona? Meaning, what's going to be a greater segula for having children? So obviously mitzvah zona. So he said, you want to strengthen that mitzvah by giving tzedakah. So he thought that the fellow, if he wants to stop doing this, if he wants to stop giving the tzedakah, he has to be matir nefesh. neder. So the thing is, if you want to be matir neder, you need a basin of three people, and at least one of them has to know the neder. So I told Shachter, the guy's going to be embarrassed. He's going to say the neder. So he said, tell him to come to yeshiva. I'll be the only dayan that knows. I said, I think that will embarrass him even more. How about I tell him to come to me? So he came to DRS, and we were matir neder, and I was the dayan that knows. What about the knife? So the you do find in Chassidus Shesvarim, dafka to use a knife, not to use a knife, but those who say to use a knife is because of achote chay lekol chayim. That Kodesh Baruch Hu is every one of these skulas, if they're based in anything, are all about being ma'orer tefillah. And this one is no different. It's not that all of a sudden it works and you do this trick and you've managed to push a button up in Shemayim and HaKadosh Baruch Hu now has to obey your commands. That's not the way it works. The whole point is that all of them are meant to be Ma'or Tefillah. The one with drinking from the Sataf, I mamish have no idea what that's about. I do know that I had lunch this past Shabbos. I was in Los Angeles and I had lunch with a doctor who was a very chashva OBGYN, and he was saying that you wouldn't believe the number of segulas he's heard about that will supposedly flip the baby around. And he says all of them sometimes work and sometimes don't work. So I don't know what to do with that. But the point over here is not just to make a mockery of those who are into the segula culture, but to be mechazik ourselves to realize that the great holy tzaddikim who believed in a lot of these things believed in tefillah first and foremost, and that certainly that should be our primary focus. Our primary goal is to connect to the Ribbono Shel Olam, because only the Ribbono Shel Olam can give us the brachos that we need. That's why tefillah is so important. By davening, we're expressing our emunah by saying that I know I can't do this without a Kadosh Baruch Hu. I know I need Hashem to give me refuah, to give me parnasah, to give me nachs for my children, to give me everything that it is that I want in life. And in the merit of drawing closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we should see that all our brachos are mekuyim.